session number 10883, reel 8.
Roundtree, reel 8. Being a Roundtree in the FAU, did this matter, you know, given the reputation of your family? Was it an advantage, a disadvantage, you know? Was there any significance to it, do you think?
I think I managed to get out of worrying about it too much. The very fact of who my parents were obviously got me in the FAU on the ground floor, and I suppose there's always some connection, merely through my name, with Roundtree and Cadbury, that I've no doubt with many who came into the FAU, particularly those from outside the Society of Friends, assumed that I was more of the purple than I actually was, so to speak. I mean, by the very fact that I had the right name to be associated with Paul Cadbury. One got a lot of jokes about it, and I remember when I had my tribunal early on in the war, PSC, Paul Cadbury, was one of the ones who came and spoke as a character witness for me. And I think about the only time I've achieved a headline in the popular press was that I got a headline in one of the London evening papers to the effect that Mr. Cadbury speaks for Mr. Roundtree, something of that kind. But I don't think I let it worry me unduly. I expect among some members of the unit there was an assumption that I was getting privileges because of my name or family. And I suppose, particularly in the early days, there was merely the fact that Paul Cadbury knew me. I mean, I was made, when I went to Finland, I was made a corporal. We had this rather curious quasi-military terminology that one or two people were designated officers without having a rank. And those who weren't officers but were one up from the mob, so to speak, were designated corporals. Don't quite know why. And I think I was a corporal when I went to Finland. I wasn't an officer, partly because, most of the two or three people who were officers were that much older. I imagine that really I became a corporal, partly because Paul Cadbury knew me and didn't know some of the others. So I think you can say that to that extent, my name or family probably got me a slightly undeserved degree of prominence early on. After that, when Paul was less involved in day-to-day matters in the unit, and when far more people were coming in from outside and there was more people knew each other, I don't think it probably made all that much difference. Though I expect there were always, as I say, some members of the unit who thought that because of my name I was something slightly different from some other members of the unit. I hope it didn't make too much difference. I don't think I was too aware of it. It was, yes, very much equality and democracy was very much part of the ethos. We did have, in the early days when we went to Finland, we adopted this sort of quasi-military terminology. After that, it was largely dropped, and we just had section leaders and others, and we didn't try playing with military quasi-ranks. It was really, I think, mainly when one was dealing with those sections that were working alongside the army. And we'll go. But certainly the unit laid great store by democracy, and there were these long arguments within sections. And I say one or two sections, I think, had palace revolutions, in a sense, and changed their own officers when they felt that a change was necessary. We had a pooled income scheme by which, certainly in most sections, I can't absolutely speak for all sections, but in all the sections I was involved in, we received the same allowance from unit funds, which I think from memory was something like 7 and 6 pence a week or something of that kind. We were all of an age when most of us hadn't had jobs before we went into the unit. Obviously, our parents were of differing circumstances and able to contribute differing amounts. And what parental contributions were made were all contributed to the same fund and then pooled along with the unit funds. And we all received the same income while we were members of the unit. So to that extent, equality was the order of the day.
Do you feel any debt at all to the CEOs of World War One?
Yes, very, very much so. I don't think that the liberality with which we were treated by the state in World War Two, and I think we have to recognise that we were treated with extraordinary liberality that I don't think any other country has achieved, particularly at a time of great crisis when, in 1940, for example, it really looked as if we might have been beaten. I don't think that degree of liberality by the state would have been achieved in anything like the same degree without the work of conscientious objectors in the First World War, not only members of the Friends Ambulance Unit, but perhaps even more so, those who took an absolutist stand and went to prison. And I think that their circumstances and their sufferings during the First World War led to an acceptance by the powers that be by 1939 that such views, odd as they might appear, could be held with genuine conviction and could indeed form part of religious conviction. And I don't think that without the work of or the situation of the COs in the First World War, I don't think that would have happened. And again, I think one's got to recognise that we really did have a very easy time, comparatively, in establishing our credibility as pacifists. I'm speaking as a Quaker, of course, and I think that one must recognise that Quakers had an easier time than others in establishing their genuineness because it was recognised that it was part of the religious beliefs of the Society of Friends. But that, in a sense, made it easier for us, and certainly the non-Quaker very often had a much harder time, both in arriving at his own genuine conscientious belief in pacifism and then in persuading the authorities that this really was so. So that I think Quakers were doubly privileged in that sense, and I think we've got to recognise that.
How easy was it settling back to normal life? I suppose it wouldn't have been normal, really, after 7 years out, would it?
No, it wasn't normal. I went into a job then, my first job.
You didn't return to Oxford?
I didn't return to Oxford, and I think I would have found going back to an academic life of study after 7 years of activity away would have been much harder than going into a job which was totally strange to me, which I'd never done before. And it certainly was strange, but I didn't find it, I think, unduly difficult. It was another job, just as going to Germany with the FAU was totally different from what I'd done in the FAU before in the Hadfield Spears unit. I mean, obviously, there were much greater differences than that, but because it was so new, I accepted it as a new experience, and I was looking forward to starting a totally different life and getting married and setting up a household and so forth, which I'd never done before. No, on the whole, I don't know that the 7 years of the wartime experience made it any harder to settle down?
The 2 years you did at Oxford, would these have been sort of wasted years so far as a degree was concerned, or were you given anything for those 2 years in recognition?
We were. If you had completed 2 years at the university at Oxford and were interrupted in your studies by the war, you were given what was called a war degree, which had no class 1, 2, or 3, and therefore had no academic standing at all, because it was given to anyone, however well or badly you would have been doing in your studies. But it did enable you to call yourself M.A. Oxon after the war. Had I been going in for an academic career of any kind, I would have had to have returned to Oxford and taken a degree in the ordinary way, because they'd have needed to know whether I was a first 2-1, 2-2, or third, or fail, or whatever. So it was really more of an honorary degree than title than anything else. It had no academic validity.
Has it ever been held against you in your work, the fact that you were a CO in World War II?
Oh, just occasionally, I think, in social occasions when one's met people who perhaps served in the war or perhaps did not like the position that COs had taken up during the war. Not professionally, I think. I don't think it's made the slightest difference. I don't know that in any job I've had that my wartime career was ever taken into account, either as a plus or a minus. There have been occasional social occasions over the years when I've been conscious of disapproval. The only occasion when I think it has been forcefully put to me was actually during the war, when I met on a social occasion a man who was subsequently, though he is not now, a member of Mrs. Thatcher's cabinet, whom I will not name, who did very forcefully express to me when I met him on a social occasion his disapproval of pacifists and conscientious objectors. But I have had disapproval expressed to me by on a few occasions, I think, but I can't think that it's been of any serious consequence.
Do you have any contact today with the peace movement? I'm wondering about something like CND. Do you belong to CND?
I've never joined CND, and I've not been active in the peace movement as such, except to the extent that work with Quaker committees in Quaker service committees of that kind is one aspect of the peace movement. My chief contact with the peace movement has been at 1 degree away, and not as personal direct involvement, and it has been as a member of one of the Roundtree Trusts, which is quite deeply involved in funding and relationships with various aspects of the peace movement, not in fact CND, because CND is not a charity and therefore can't be funded, but with quite a number of charitable aspects involved in the peace movement, such as research bodies and this kind of thing. So I have in fact had quite a number of contacts with branches of the peace movement, but I've never been an activist myself and have never been a member of CND.
What do you think of CND? Have you any particular feelings about the organisation?
I admire a lot of what they've done without feeling able to get personally involved. I think that their chief success and their chief virtue, in a way, has been to keep the issue of peace and war, disarmament deterrence and so forth, as an active subject of debate in the population in a way that without a body like CND, I don't think would have occurred without them. I don't think that they can probably claim to have influenced policy in any great degree, and I suspect that the fact that it's genuinely held that one-sided unilateral disarmament is generally held to be a vote loser rather than a vote winner, suggests that CND has not managed to achieve a great deal in the way of affecting policy. In fact, in some respects, I think some of the perhaps less publicised and noisy diplomacy that and contacts and investigation and research that's gone on behind the scenes may possibly have had more influence over the years than a mass movement like CND. I may well be wrong about that, but it certainly has been useful, I think, in keeping the issue of disarmament as a proper subject for debate and consideration by people generally.
Mm-hmm. Nuclear disarmament, I suppose.
Nuclear disarmament, this is, yes, yes. Yeah.
Yes, because it's not really an anti-war organization.
It's specifically related to nuclear disarmament, of course.
So how do you feel about the world situation today, you know, the international situation? Do you feel optimistic or what?
Gracious, that's a big one. I think one's bound to say that since the advent of Mr. Gorbachev, one's feeling a great deal more optimistic than one would have been 5-10 years ago, when it did look as if the chances of nuclear war breaking out were possibly a little greater than even. That would appear to have receded to some extent, though no doubt it's far from certain that rational views on either side, both the both from the Soviet side or from the military machine side in the West, will necessarily prevail. But I think that yes, I feel cautiously optimistic at the moment that we shall get away without a major nuclear war. Having said that, I see little prospect of the many small-scale wars that have gone on in the last 30 years ceasing, and I don't know that we're in any better position to achieve real-world peace than we were at the end of the war. And in a sense, we've had surrogate wars going on in many of the smaller countries for the last 40 years, and I suspect that those will continue to go on for a considerable time. But yes, I do feel more optimistic that we shall get away without a major Holocaust at the moment.
If the worst did happen and there was another war, a world war, do you see a role for the FAU? You know, do you think it would be reactivated again as it was in the Second World War?
We've discussed this considerably, and without any of us being able to prophesy what the next role for the next kind of war will be. We have always acted on the assumption that if there was another war, the FAU would be revived, in the sense that we have maintained a modest nucleus of funds in the Friends Ambulance Unit, which would enable us to start something. Well, when I say us, it would be another generation than mine, but would enable somebody to reactivate an FAU if that seemed right. Though one's bound to say that with the increasing developments of firepower, and particularly nuclear power, each war is going to be different, and I think that the next war, if by any chance it should occur, will be far more different from the 39-45 war than that was from the 14-18 war. And it's difficult to see at the moment what kind of a role an FAU might have in a war, because on the face of it, a war might last only 10 minutes as such. Though no doubt in Reconstruction terms, there would be a job for something like the FAU. The other thing is that I think that one has to say that the FAU was a product of conscription. I'm not clear that without conscription, the FAU would have come into existence in the same way. It might or it might not, but it was the impetus of conscription that pushed people into trying to find a way of an outlet for service for conscientious objectors who otherwise wouldn't have had this outlet. And one doesn't know whether conscription or something similar would apply in the case of a next war. The other factor, I think, is the increasing growth of other organisations taking on people, such as Oxfam or International Voluntary Service or VSO or the Red Cross or whatever, and whether in those circumstances it would be right to add another specifically pacifist organisation, I don't know. The people involved at the time it occurred would have to decide on that. But we have tried to make it at least possible for an FAU to be revived, if that was thought right at the time, by maintaining a modest balance of funds, the income from which at the moment we give away each year to other bodies actively involved in the field, such as Quaker Peace and Service or bodies such of that kind. But we've kept the capital intact in case it should be needed.
And finally, Michael, I haven't asked you about women and their role in the FAU, explicitly, that is. And you would have had, presumably, experience of this in Germany and the relief work. What were the sort of proportions of women to men in Germany?
I'd have to look that up. Oh, in Germany, the relief teams in Germany were all or mostly mixed. I think that there might have been one or two teams that were all male, but they were certainly mostly mixed. And at a guess, I would have said that women formed perhaps 20% of the membership. Women in the FAU generally, of course, started later than men. The original FAU was entirely male, partly, I think, because conscription didn't hit women until later on in the war. Then it was my sister, Tessa, now Tessa Cadbury, who, with Gwendy Knight, started up the women's FAU. I would have to check on the facts, I'm afraid, or you can get them from other sources, as to the actual numbers of women compared with men in the FAU. I didn't come across women in the FAU until my time in Germany after the war, because being overseas, we had no FAU women in the Hatfield Spears, though we had two women who came in as nurses who subsequently joined the FAU after the war but were not in the FAU at the time. And so my personal experience is limited to after the war, when I would hazard a guess that perhaps a fifth or a quarter of the teams were women. And women did play a very useful role in the unit, not only at headquarters, but also in the various fields of operation at home. I don't think they went overseas until after the war, until the civilian relief work in Northwest Europe, because the openings for women were obviously limited overseas during the war. So I think that the civilian relief in Europe was the first occasion on which they could have served overseas. Prior to that, I think they were mostly working in hospitals, rest centre, shelter work, relief service of one kind or another in this country.
Mm-hmm. And in your work as administrator in Germany, did you give women special jobs, or were they expected to do the same work as men?
By and large, they were given the same work as men, but not being involved in the day-to-day operations, it would have been more the job of the team leader within the team to decide how he or she allocated the work within the team. And no doubt in that, he took note of the skills and qualifications of all of them, men and women. I would not myself have been involved in allocating specific work to individuals within the team. And I think the general principle within the unit was that anyone should be prepared and as far as possible able to take on any job within the sphere that that the group or the section or the team was working. But obviously women had some qualities that men hadn't and vice versa. And I can see that they would be given, in some cases, different jobs from the men. But I don't think that would be any suggestion, or I hope not, that they should be limited to being cooks or secretaries or whatever. I can see that they would have some jobs, particularly, I think, in civilian relief, where you're dealing with large numbers of people in very distressing circumstances. There would be many situations where women would be judged more sympathetic or more acceptable to women refugees, this kind of thing. But basically, I think the ethos of the unit was to try and create situations where anyone, male or female, was in a position as far as possible to do the same kind of job.
Well, Michael, thank you very much indeed for sharing so many of your very interesting experiences with me. Thank you very much.
Not at all. I'm afraid I've gone at much greater length than I should have done.
Thank you.